On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the breakout Hollywood hit, The Devil Wears Prada, actress Meryl Streep plays an icy, larger-than-life tyrant of the fashion publishing industry, imperious, sadistic, and in her world, incredibly powerful. But you don't have to go to the movies to find the model for that powerhouse. Everyone knows it's Anna Wintour, the fashion superpower, editor-in-chief of Vogue magazine. And this week, likely as not to be alongside a glittering runway as Fashion Week sweeps New York City. If the gowns and looks and wild baubles seem miles away today, remember, tomorrow their echoes will be at Ann Taylor and Target and on your block. Up next on Point, The Devil Who Wore Prada, Anna Wintour, and the fashion imprint on America. Joining me first today from New York is Terry Eggins. She's senior fashion reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Terry Eggins, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, here we are. It's New York's big week on the fashion front. Is Anna Wintour in evidence?
Oh, yes. Anna is in the house, and she's on the front row, as always, often with her dark shades. And so are something like 3,000 credentialed media from all over the world. And, you know, Tom, I've been covering this industry for about 18 years
yes.
or so, and it's just incredible how we're getting... You know, the New York Fashion Week has become a big deal. I mean, we're designers here who are showing from Russia, Brazil. There's even a designer from China. And it just really shows the importance of New York as a hub for, fashion. And then just how the globalization has really affected this.
A lot of draw and a lot of clothes and a lot of models on the runway from behind those Anna Wintour dark glasses or the other 3,000 and everybody else who's attending. Terry, give us a sense of what they're seeing on the runway, the catwalk headline here in your newspaper, retro silhouettes, deep hues. What's the look? Is there a look this season?
Well, the thing is that because fashion has become so, you know, scattered, international and everything, you really do see a variety of things. But clearly, one of the trends that we started to see even before the show started, because we did poll a lot of the designers, is that there seems to be a kind of a movement toward a kind of a, what we call a grown-up, more grown-up look, more tailored clothes. Last Christmas, or last rather fall, we went into a lot of the layered look, which is still, you know, working now, especially in these cold temperatures. But it seems that next fall you're going to see a much more tailored look. Last night at Marc Jacobs, it was really incredible. This is the guy who brought you grunge, and he did a very sophisticated kind of take on Hollywood glamour with picture hats and cloche hats and low-slung silhouettes. So, you know, it's all over the map. But we still have to go through this ritual in London, Milan, and Paris before, you know, we know the actual trends.
We'll see it all over. One of your colleagues describes it as structured silhouettes reminiscent of the 1950s, high-waisted skirts, full-structured sleeves, pants and coats with wide collars in the style of Jackie Kennedy's wardrobe, and colors rich and deep, navy blue, forest green, and magenta. You mentioned models. I'm looking at another piece from the Wall Street Journal here, talking about how the supermodel has been kind of downgraded. You say globalization, Terry. Models just coming out of the woodwork from all over the place. 15,000 subscriptions a month at models.com from mainly women, I guess, in Bulgaria and Kazakhstan and Mozambique looking to get up on the catwalk. What's happened to the supermodel?
Well, what's happened, I remember when I started, and this was the era of the supermodel, we're talking about Cindy Crawford and Naomi Campbell, Linda Evangelista, a lot of names that everybody remembers. And these women were, basically just did runway shows. They really weren't part of the whole print. They weren't also in magazines the way, the fashion industry has changed so much. And the supermodel kind of really lost a lot of its allure because... A lot of the companies didn't want to pay the prices that they had to pay in the past. And then also you got this, you know, in the zeal to get models, you know, who are, you know, thin and fetching, they went with girls that are younger and younger. I mean, there are models out here now that are 13 and 14 years old.
Wow.
And so it's really kind of changed the whole a look of the shows. And also, I think a lot of the designers did not want these supermodels to upstage their clothes, because these girls now are totally kind of anonymous. I don't even remember one name from the other. In the past, you know, we could, you know, we knew which ones, we knew their names and where they were from.
But, anonymous and extremely skinny. There's been a controversy around that at other venues around the planet. Has that come to New York City as well with Fashion Week? Are people saying, we're insisting that our models starve themselves near death?
Well, yesterday, in fact, they had a press conference to talk about some of the guidelines that the Council of Fashion Designers in New York is trying to promote for models on the runway, and they're trying to promote healthy eating habits, and there's no smoking backstage anymore, which used to be a big thing. A lot of models used to subsist on cigarettes and coffee and champagne backstage, so a lot of that's changed. But I think that, you know, that there's probably, the pendulum is going to swing back to not necessarily the supermodel look, which was more voluptuous, but certainly women who just are a little bit older and just really can show the clothes better. Because it's not even the age, I mean, the skinniness bothers me, I think, as much as it. A lot of these girls are just, they look like children, they don't walk well, and they just don't have a sense of themselves that you get when you're a lot more mature.
When you're more self-possessed, and no,
of course,
no major bank. They're saying $0 to $1,000 to walk down the runway this time. And for many, just the clothes on their back, they model for trade. They get to keep their outfits.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, well, the thing is this, too, is that as this Fashion Week has become such a big deal, there are, you know, just hundreds of shows, and many of these young designers don't have the money, and so that's, you know, there's been a kind of a markdown in terms of the models, that a lot of models are great just to get the exposure, so they will, you know, perform in the show for free. And, you know, that's also ratcheted down, you know, a lot of the rates.
Mm. Terry, put Anna Wintour in the middle of this for us. The Devil Wears Prada brought her or through the Miranda Priestly, played by Meryl Streep there, the notion of her to an awful lot of Americans. Is she that scary, and is she that central to the fashion business in this country?
Well, the first thing is that you do have to remember that Anna is not that character. I mean, that was a caricature. That was a Romana Clay.
But written by a young woman who had worked for her. So.
Yeah, had worked for her.
Right.
And but the whole point is that, I mean, there's no mistake that Anna is the, you know, main player in the whole fashion world, because she's just crossed. She's a power broker who's crossed a lot of different areas. Not only is this going way beyond just the brand of the Vogue magazine. I mean, she is influential in designers getting jobs. Mr. Arnault, who's head of LVMH, I know that he did talk with her when he was discussing hiring John Galliano at Dior and Marc Jacobs at Louis Vuitton.
Mm-hmm.
She's also been incredible in terms of helping really make the Costume Institute party, which is for the museum here, a really big moneymaker. And, you know, and drawing a lot of Hollywood in addition to society, and that's, you know, been great for the industry. Plus, she's done a lot to really promote a lot of young designers who are underfinanced with the fashion fund that they do, which is a kind of a contest.
And Terry, what about that industry itself that she sits kind of at the head of, a sort of a crown jewel or power broker, as you say? It can look, you know, very ephemeral, the playground of the rich, and sometimes maybe not even that. I don't know who wears some of the clothes we see on the catwalk, but as an industry, you're with the Wall Street Journal, as a piece of economic action, how important is it to New York, to, I don't know, the national economy?
Okay, well, it's huge. I mean, in the fashion industry, just in the United States, generates, I know, more than $100 billion, billion of sales just in women's and men's apparel alone. And then you've got, you know, we're not getting into all the shoes and handbags and fragrance and all the other tertiary products. And the other thing is that fashion has become a big, important part of our lives. It's now a big part of pop culture, just like in Hollywood. I mean, you've got all these reality shows. You know, you've got Ugly Betty, America's Top Model. I mean, people are really interested in following this as a sport. People, just like they follow the box office take of different movies, you know, people are really interested in this whole industry, and that's why celebrities have tied to it. And so it is a big deal, and fashion is an important part of our lives. We all stress every day we make those decisions. It has a lot to do with your self-image, how you're regarded by people, whether you're dressing up or casually. It says a lot about you.
So are we dressing out of Anna Wintour's closet or taste at some level, even once it's, you know, filtered all the way down to Ann Taylor and Target and you name it? Or is it just the high tier where her fingerprints are really evident, Terry?
Well, no, the whole point is that Anna is just one of the many important cogs in this whole big fashion machine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fashion magazines, obviously, not just Vogue, but you know, Elle and Harper's Bazaar and W, you know, they have a lot to do with exposing people to the top tier of fashion. But you've also got fashion coming from a lot of other big forces. You've got the cheap chic from Zara and H&M. You've got what's going on at Target. Then, you know, just a lot of the clever things that have happened through the years. You know, you think of Banana Republic and Gap and Victoria's Secret. So, you know, there's just so many components here that have made this a big deal. But the marketing, you know, fashion has to be marketed. People have to have desire to want, they have to dream, they have to want to keep buying clothes, and clothes don't necessarily wear out. And they've got to go out of style, and someone's got to make people move. And so this is part of this whole machine, and it sounds very mysterious, and I think the industry wants people to believe
right.
it.
Terry Agins, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, the movie was a big kind of surprise hit in its scale. Meryl Streep plays Miranda Priestly, top editor of the fictional Runway magazine. Here she is icily explaining to her assistant that even the old sweater the young assistant wears is indebted to designer clothes shown on the runway.
What you don't know is that that sweater is not just blue, it's not turquoise, it's not lapis, it's actually cerulean. And you're also blithely unaware of the fact that in 2002, Oscar de la Renta did a collection of cerulean gowns, and then I think it was Yves Saint Laurent, wasn't it, who showed cerulean military jackets? I think we need a jacket here.
Mm.
And then cerulean quickly showed up in the collections of eight different designers. And then it filtered down through the department stores, and then trickled on down into some tragic casual corner where you no doubt fished it out of some clearance bin. However, that blue represents millions of dollars and countless jobs. And it's sort of comical how you think that you've made a choice that exempts you from the fashion industry when in fact you're wearing a sweater that was selected for you by the people in this room from a pile of stuff.
From a pile of stuff, and pretty soon it's not lapis, it's actually cerulean, and we're off to the races there with Meryl Streep playing Miranda Priestly in The Devil Wears Prada. We're looking at the model, Anna Wintour, editor-in-chief of Vogue magazine and American Fashion. We're joined right now from New York by two great observers. One, Kathy Horn, is with us. She covers fashion for The New York Times. Kathy, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And with us from New York, Tim Gunn. He's chair of the Fashion Design Department at the Parsons, the new school for design, appears regularly on the Bravo television show Project Runway, where he mentors the show's design contestants. This spring, he'll star in his own show, Tim Gunn's Guide to Style. Tim Gunn, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Thrilled to be with you. And Kathy.
Kathy, first to you, you're writing still about Anna Wintour. You know, she's been around in this very high place for such a long time, and you're writing just last week that she's still way up there. She's still the power in this industry. How does that work?
Well, you know, the fashion business is constantly changing, and the players changed significantly in the late 90s when most of the big Paris houses changed owners, and a new group of people came in who were, you know, guys like, you know, Bernard Arnault and the Pinos and Domenico De Sole, who was a lawyer who took over Gucci with Tom Ford. And, you know, I think that the landscape changed so much. You suddenly had all these corporate guys who, you know, they weren't running the houses the way the old families had run the houses. You had a big turnover of designers, and all of a sudden you had, you know, editors like, you know, Anna, going back to Vreeland's day and John Fairchild's day at Farnsworth Daily, they always had a role in the business, a supportive role. But I think it changed quite a bit in the last 10 years, and I think Anna has sort of purposely, you know, played a bigger role in that.
How does it work? What are the mechanics? How does Anna Wintour become the superpower here?
Well, she has a tremendous commitment to the business and to, you know, I think many of the people I spoke to in doing that story said over and over again, she does this because she's, you know, she sees herself as a supporter of American fashion. You know, but I think she also is, you know, she's a tremendously organized woman. She's very thorough about things. She has tremendous follow-through.
And what she's following through on, as you describe it, is editor Anna Wintour going straight to the corporate guys who own these houses and essentially practically telling them who to promote, who to put up high, what designers to get up there. She's kind of half calling the shots.
Yeah, she, well, in a way. But what she does is, you know, she... There are a lot of, you know, people sort of floating around, a lot of designers floating around who either are out of jobs or changing houses. And if she believes that they are, you know, they're talented, she gets behind them. And then she'll go to, she'll, you know, talk to François-Henri Pinault, for instance, who's the chief executive of one of the big French luxury groups, and say, look, here's Phoebe Philo. She used to be the designer at Chloe. What can we do? She needs, you know, but Anna is very careful, I must say, about not saying to these chief executives what the relationship should be. And those, she says, look, Phoebe's out here, she's talented, see what you can do. It's like Claudio Del Vecchio said from Brooks Brothers when she proposed that Tom Brown, a menswear designer, do something, a special collection with Brooks Brothers. And she saw a very talented young designer and a company like Brooks, which was undergoing a big makeover. So she says, why not put these two people together? It makes sense. And so then she says, you know, she brings Claudio Del Vecchio to Tom Brown's fashion show.
Okay.
And then I just assume, frankly, Tom, that was the end of the deal. That the end, you know, it was like, here's an introduction. And both Del Vecchio and Brown said to me, oh, no, she stayed involved. And what she did was was get on the phone and call Del Vecchio and say, look, are you guys still talking? And Del Vecchio said she put a lot of pressure on me, but it wasn't the pressure to... you know, what to say, what the deal should be. It was just to keep talking. But that's very persuasive. And it's like François-Henri Pinault said, you know, it's a very positive way of demonstrating her power. She lets you know that if you can do something that she wants, she will support you with her magazine.
And again, they do. You quote Del Vecchio saying, I don't feel I owe her anything or that she owes me anything. But the designers end up very often where Anna Wintour is pushing Tim Gunn. What does it mean to a young designer when, if Anna Wintour gets behind him or her?
Well, it's indisputably the case that Anna Wintour is a kingmaker. So for her to get behind you and your collection and believe in you, the sky's the limit, quite literally. And it's happened here in my time at Parsons in a number of cases, and most recently with the Proenza Schooler phenomenon, graduates from 2002. Anna had seen the collection on the Parsons runway, and she was enthralled by it. And I know that she was influential in Julie Gillhart buying it for Barney's. And it was a first time for us here, the first time that just about to be graduates were picked up by this industry in this capacity. I mean, our graduates have been going into assistant designer positions largely.
Right.
So this was a phenomenon.
The Anna Wintour supercharged there. Tim, describe for us, if you would, I mean, with all this impact, can we see, we're not all aficionados of fashion listening here, but can you describe a look that we're surrounded by today or a range of looks that we're surrounded by because Anna Wintour is pushing people? I mean, her reputation is that she's the one who killed grunge. She won't let fur die. But is there a look? Do we wear Anna Wintour's taste at some level, no matter how far we are from the runway?
Well, I have to say, I really don't believe that every designer whom Anna champions is necessarily her taste. I believe that she believes that in her capacity as editor-in-chief of Vogue, she has a responsibility to represent many different points of view, and I believe that she does that exceedingly well. But there is no doubt that what we see in both in the editorial realm and in the retail world has her mark on it. But I will also say she has quality taste and style. This is a woman with a very cultivated point of view and a very high-end point of view, and we need editors to be looking at that high end. The industry will respond by trickling down, dumbing things down. But if it doesn't begin at a very high level, it has almost nowhere to go.
Mm. Kathy Horn, explain for a schlub like me, how does it trickle down? What starts, you know, way up there in Milan or Paris or this week in New York on the catwalk, how does it end up in mass merchandising or some echo of it, mass merchandising kind of venues where millions of Americans buy it or some form of it?
I just want to add something to what Tim said about, you know, the taste of Vogue. And
yes, please.
This is, you know, it's something that everybody talks about here in New York during the shows, and whether there's a tendency for young designers to do clothes that please Anna. I think that, you know, what we see in Vogue, actually, that we have a situation in New York where you don't really have two competitive, you know, two strong competitive fashion magazines like you used to have with Harper's Bazaar and Vogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's a problem just generally that you, if you don't have that kind of, you know, edginess between that sort of competitiveness, you tend to have one person being able to dominate more. And the designers will say, I'm concerned about what Anna thinks.
And is there a look that you associate with that? Can you look out across the whole sort of world you're looking at there and see the fingerprints?
Yeah. I mean, what I think is that there is a very kind of, I would say it's broadly, it's a very rich sort of look.
And rich as in wealthy.
Rich as in wealthy. And I think it doesn't reflect a diversity of taste in this country. And, I mean, that has always been, I mean, Vogue has always been traditionally, a glamorous magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Why should it suddenly sort of go down market or look at something, you know, different? But we have a lot of, you know, we have, it's not a very broadly, doesn't look, you know, it doesn't reflect race diversity. It doesn't reflect cultural diversity. It reflects really kind of one view that we see in New York and Los Angeles.
Does it end up trickling down to make a lot of Americans look like, you know, little Richie Rich or poor little rich girl wannabes?
I think it probably does. And I think you see it a lot. I mean, so maybe it also has to do with some of the so-called cultural icons have been, whether it's a Paris Hilton or it's a Britney Spears or some of the young women that we see all the time in Us Weekly and People and those places. But, I think the problem is that you tend to not be as critical of things because they seem to run very well. And you think, well, this is nice taste. It looks good. But you say, hold on a minute. Is this really reflect the world today? Does this really reflect? I mean, you know, you come to New York, you go to London, you see kids, you know, dressing in amazing ways. And that you don't really see in the magazines too well. And maybe they're pleasing their advertisers, who are generally the big luxury companies.
Mm.
I just wanted to put my two cents in
that.
I do think that I think she's very good at what she does, and the magazine is tremendously successful, and I have a lot of respect for Anna. But I think it's important. When I was doing the piece, one of the things I felt like, I'm not so sure it's odd, for instance, it's maybe strange to a lot of us, certainly strange to a lot of people here at the New York Times when they found out she was having conversations with with CEOs about who should work at those houses. But I maintain that you have to look at the totality of her control. And then you begin to wonder, well, if she can tell designers what to design, or she can suggest, suggest this is what she likes. I mean, I have some of the models told me that they felt like, you know, that she has a definite taste in models.
Even body type and look and all the rest.
I mean, where do you really want someone like that also dictating who should go work at houses?
Wow, powerful woman, almost an iron hand being described here, and a hand that's all over the place, maybe even on our backs. Kathy, Tim Gunn, please stand by. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us. Suzanne is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Suzanne. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I want to, as a writer about political culture, I wanted to make a point about a different kind of fashion statement that is being made and being discussed in your discussion and also in the movie and the book. And you talk about totality of control over fashion and what people wear, but I think that there's also a totality of control over how people behave and think about themselves and other people. And what was so interesting to me about The Devil Wears Prada was that, and Tom, you caught it absolutely perfectly in that little snippet that you played,
Meryl
with
Streep,
how
yeah.
she took a girl who had absolutely no interest in fashion, didn't know the magazine, didn't know the world, and really transformed her behavior so that she instantly accepted and was socialized almost instantly into accepting this kind of outrageous totalitarian control of an employer over, you know, the people who work with her, so that she would snap to it for these absolutely outrageous demands.
Do you take that as a reflection of reality? Do you see that going on? What do you make of it?
It happens all the time. I mean, I see it in the work that I write about and the people I write about. I mean, people instantly socialized into behaving and accepting. It's more acquiescing to to the demands of an employer or some power, more powerful figure, so that they really start hurting themselves, hurting other people, and accepting demands on them. I mean, and you know, this kind of behavior is always justified by what kind of wonderful work the person does. When I wrote an expose about the world of ballet, Balanchine, who was essentially the Jim Jones of New York City Ballet and was really responsible for the starvation and deaths of some dancers who died of anorexia, although we never heard of it.
Big claim.
You know, everything he did was justified by, oh my God, he's such a wonderful choreographer. And look what he's done. And
Suzanne, we've got the critique, and it's a tough one. Let me put it to our guest, Tim Gunn. What about it? Fashionistas, fashion superpowers like Anna Wintour as a kind of tyranny and tyrants. What do you say to that view?
Well, I mean, Suzanne certainly has a very good point. I mean, I would say that if you're going to be working side by side with a powerhouse who's difficult and demanding, in some ways the only way to survive is to drink the Kool-Aid. Otherwise, you just should get out. But I understand the consequences of perceptions of abusive behavior and outrageous demands. But I don't want to excuse them or trivialize them, but they persist everywhere in some manner or form. I will say that I say to my Parsons students all the time, whenever they demonstrate any semblance of attitude, which they
just might,
pull them into my office and say, you know something? You have to be part of the solution here, and by behaving this way, you're simply fueling perceptions about this industry that I really want to dispel.
Creative designers without attitude, Lord, what next? Kathy?
I'll add, too, Tom, that I say if this industry were to get rid of everyone who's high maintenance, there would be no one left.
Yeah, off they go. Kathy Holmes, we've just got you for another minute and a half here. First, on this issue of tyranny versus creativity in the world that Anna leads, And then just the broader question of, you know, does fashion even matter? Our caller, Suzanne, suggests it conveys a kind of get-in-line message right down through society.
No, I think she's right in many ways, but she is talking about a sort of broader issue, and it can happen. You can look at it in many areas. But I do think that fashion matters a lot more. I mean, tremendously. I mean, look at we just started a blog at the Times, big response to it. People love to talk about it, and they like to talk about it on a serious level, too. They like to talk about it in terms of its relationship to contemporary art. They like to talk about its sociological implications. They like to talk about the clothes. They like about what people were doing, whether was that designer to have a good collection or a bad collection. People weigh in on a variety of topics. I think also it's like, look at the companies and the way they view other companies outside of the fashion world, like cell phone companies, the way they decorate those phones, the way they design those phones. You could argue that that's the influence of fashion. It's the car you drive. We're all kind of obsessed by style and appearance, and I would say that fashion has had a big impact. There's the real reality. I mean, there's the real aspects of jobs and all that, which is important. But I think it sort of leaks through society now, and it's not the upper tier that is interested in it anymore.
Mm. Kathy, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's hear from the movie once more, and then from the woman herself. In The Devil Wears Prada, the top editor, Miranda Priestly, previews designers' collections, like Anna Wintour. Here, her staff is carefully reading her body language to determine if she likes what she sees.
This season really began for me with a meditation on the intersection between East and West.
There's a scale. One nod is good, two nods is very good. There's only been one actual smile on record, and that was Tom Ford in 2001.
An Obie belt.
If she doesn't like it, she shakes her head.
This is the dress that we have designed specifically and exclusively for you.
And of course, there's the pursing of the lips.
Which means?
The nod, the pursing of the lips. There's the movie. Now let's hear Anna Wintour herself, here interviewed by Barbara Walters in December. Barbara Walters asked her if the mood of the country affects fashion.
Absolutely it affects fashion. We were so interested at Vogue to see how militant many of the collections were.
Because of the war.
Because of the war. I mean, there was a real sense there of the women on the runways were going into battle. Since the election results in November, talking to many of the designers, I feel that they are now so optimistic and thrilled at the idea of change and possible withdrawal from Iraq. That's going to be reflected on the runways next September.
British-born, editor-in-chief of Vogue magazine, Anna Wintour, there talking with Barbara Walters. And yes, she says, reality affects fashion, and it turns right back as well. 800-423-8255 is our number. We're joined now from New York by Harriet Mays Powell. She's the fashion director of New York magazine. Harriet Mays Powell, thanks a lot for being here.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Guilford, Connecticut, Marianne LaFrance. She's professor of psychology and women and gender studies at Yale. Marianne LaFrance, thank you for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Marianne LaFrance, first to you. You've got the big picture on women. You probably saw the movie. You know how the fashion industry works. Does it have its little hooks in all of us, in women in particular, and how deep, how significantly, or is it fluff on a catwalk?
Oh, it's certainly not fluff. Fashion, clothing have a huge impact on both what other people think of us as well as what we think about ourselves.
Harriet Mays Powell, what about Anna Wintour herself? You've written about, it was a few years back, she was kind of tumbling. Her marriage was breaking up after an affair, and she was losing staff at Vogue, and there were all kinds of questions flying around her. Bring us up to date on where this woman's life and impact stand as you see it from your perch in New York.
She had a personal problem, which certainly, if anyone looks at the statistics of marriage, she's not the only one to have had a divorce.
Absolutely, sure.
But what's really important, I think, is to see this woman, and I've known her for a long time and have been in the industry for quite a while, and she's mesmerizing. I mean, the power that she contains and controls behind the dark glasses, sitting in the front row, poised, doesn't speak very often. You know, there's a mystery and a power around her that is, I find, still captivating all these years later. And I think you've really got to look at Anna's love for the industry. Her position at Vogue and the fortuitous one of being with that magazine and that word which is synonymous with the top and the best of fashion. Mm. And Anna has capitalized that five-letter word, and she's made it into a mega brand. There's Men's Vogue, there's Teen Vogue, there's Vogue Living. And she's used her power, and probably slightly out of boredom after 17 years or whatever, mm-hmm. whatever it was that Kathy Horn told us about.
I think it's 18 now.
18. She's probably a little bit bored doing a September issue. You know, it's a little like Groundhog Day. It keeps coming.
So let's flex the muscles that she's built.
And let's get involved, and let's make fashion bigger and more important. And simultaneously, that's all happening with the growth of luxury goods and all these big corporate players at LVMH and the big luxury houses in Europe. And at the same time, there's a globalization factor going on, which is riveting. So, you know, Anna's rise at power at Vogue is happening at the same time when the luxury goods business is having this unbelievable moment of influence and affluence. And then similarly, clothing is being produced so quickly from the catwalks that you're able to get fashion very quickly. So the whole thing is a kind of whirlwind of a perfect storm, be it, of fashion making this big, big, big rise in the cultural landscape of our lives.
And you know her. What do you think she does it for? Does Anna Wintour do all this pushing and pushing for beauty, for the rich, for Vogue's bottom line, for the culture somehow? How do you think she sees the motivation in herself?
I think she passionately loves fashion, Tom. I think she's a woman that thinks great clothes, looking great, is a fantastically fun job. I'm a fashion director of a different magazine and do a different kind of a fashion job. But, you know, as I love to say, it's just such a great day job. I get to look at beautiful clothes, pick them, talk to designers about them. I mean, it's fun. And I think Anna believes in that as a power. I think she believes in fashion as a force, and is using all of the things that she can with the new houses as the owners of Vogue and Condé Nast to help her in her position of authority. And she's spreading that, I think, actually quite diplomatically and quite fairly to the people around the world. I mean, major people like Marc Jacobs in New York fashion, John Galliano, who does Christian Dior, they would not, in my professional opinion, be here today if Anna and her team had not basically saved them from the very tricky and treacherous early days of a designer's career when things can go belly up pretty quickly.
Fashion as a force, and Anna Wintour wielding it. Listeners, what do you think? Let's go to Joan in Buffalo. Hi, Joan. You're on the air.
Hi. Fashion does matter. I think another layer of this really interesting conversation is history of fashion. I've worked in the fashion industry in many capacities over, like, almost 30 years now, from designing to wholesaling to retailing. Mm. And the most fascinating job that I had concerning fashion was as a costume designer for film and television, where you're actually packaging the site, you're doing the packaging for the psychological of a character. And I think that a lot of people are really ignorant to fashion history, which is really interesting.
But Joan, are we all doing that every day? Or when we make those buying decisions, are we packaging our character, our psyche somehow?
Absolutely. I feel that so strongly. So, you know, whether, and it really depends, too, where, you know, if you're in a large city such as New York or Paris or someplace, or if you're in a small place such as I am now in Buffalo, your outlets to be able to purchase fashion are limited in smaller places. But you have this expansive media right now that's just putting it out there. And P.S., I've been reading New York Magazine like my entire adult life, and I think they do a spectacular job each season.
So kudos to Harriet Mays Powell.
What's going on, and I have issues probably back to 83 that I still use for
research. Watch out. You'll get termites in there. Be careful. Joan, thanks very much for that. Marion LaFrance, what about it? Fashion as liberating in to the extent that it packages our personalities, or confining? How do you look at it as a psychologist?
It is confining. I think, let me take the dark side of fashion. Mm. Fashion is something that we have to engage in. We cannot not wear clothes. We then, by how we wear them, come across as a particular kind of person, as a particular social class, as being identified with a particular point of view. Even when we elect not to be fashionable, we are being fashionable in an anti-fashion sense.
Right,
that is,
right.
Our clothes say a lot about who we are. The dark side of this, from my standpoint as a women's studies scholar and a psychologist, is the tyrannical role that fashion and body and hair play on, especially on young women, so that they grow up believing that their self-worth absolutely depends upon how others regard what they look like. So they try to model, as they say, I think in the movie there was something reflecting the fact that the size 8 is the new size 14. That is, the belief that to be fashionable is to be thin, to be fashionable is to be young, to be fashionable is primarily to be of a certain body type.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of us fail, by definition. And what it does, especially for the young, is create a sense that if you are being primarily evaluated for how you look, which women are, and you can't measure up either because your finances or your body or any number of other factors won't allow that to happen, you start out life being a failure.
So there's a kind of trap in it, but a kind of joy also. Tim Gunn, I want to hear you on that, but we've got a caller with you in mind here from Ontario, Canada. Lisa is on the line. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Tim. It's really exciting to be talking to Tim today.
You know Tim from his television work on Project Runway?
I do. I know Tim from Project Runway. I'm an avid fan.
Thank you so much.
That's great. And Lisa, how do you see fashion as liberating or enslaving?
Well, I'm really interested in Tim's take on fashion, and I just wanted to say how much I have loved watching him at work on Project Runway, and the way that he responds to the designers, the way that he gives feedback that is positive and constructive and yet honest and very much from the heart. I think it really is changing our culture to show a way of giving feedback that is constructive but also very direct.
Is he the opposite of the Miranda Priestly character, the opposite of Meryl Streep in the movie, Lisa?
Perhaps. I hadn't thought of it that way, but perhaps it is the opposite. So, you know, he tells his designers to make it work, and it's his way of saying, you know, you've got to get the job done. I love you, but don't complain.
Right. Lisa, thanks. Tim Gunn, what about it? Does kinder, gentler work in your world? And where do you stand on this issue of fashion as liberating of creativity and fun and joy, or, you know, enslaving, in that, as Marion LaFrance says, most people, and particularly women, may easily see themselves as failing compared to the waifs on the runway?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts about this, and one is that it is absolutely true that how we present ourselves to the world is a kind of semiology. It sends a message about how we want to be perceived. But I have to also say I really believe it's important that for us to be who we are, and that means any size, any shape, and all the variables that go along with that, because I really believe that we can all look great. And I think that to be a size 14 doesn't mean that you throw your hands up in the air and say, well, I can't possibly make a go of life in this particular manner because I'm simply too large. You can still look really great, but it's about understanding the proportions of clothes and silhouettes that look best on you, colors that look best, textures, patterns, things of that sort that really enhance how you look. I'm a big advocate for championing many different sizes and shapes, as I've said. And in terms of critical feedback, I only believe in talking to students and to the Project Runway designers and to anyone else with whom I interact. I only believe in talking to them about things that they can change. And if it's something that can't be changed, why bother even bringing up the topic? And I also believe that it's very important to be supportive in your criticism. And with my students and with the Project Runway designers, I only want them to succeed.
Is Anna that kind?
I don't see Anna being that kind. I see her giving feedback with more of a blunt instrument, but in her own way it works for her. So who am I to say?
Right.
But I also have to – I just want to make one comment, Tom, about the semiology of clothes and specifically the movie The Devil Wears Prada, because if we were to remove all of the dialogue from Anne Hathaway's character, the clothes that she wears – tell the story. It's remarkable. It's remarkable, and I found it absolutely riveting when I saw it, and one of the most strong and powerful and potent moments in my movie going ever.
And not just you, Tim Gunn at Parsons, the new school for design of Project Runway, with his own show, Tim Gunn's Guide to Style, coming out. I know we have to let you go, Tim. Thanks for joining us.
Tom, thank you so much. I enjoyed it tremendously.
Let's hear what Anna Wintour thought of the movie. Here she is talking with Barbara Walters again.
I thought the film was really entertaining. I mean, anything that makes fashion entertaining and glamorous and interesting is wonderful for our industry. So I was 100% behind it.
Did you recognize any part of yourself?
Well, I'm a very decisive person. I think it's actually helpful to people that you are working with, that you can make decisions. So if Meryl seemed somewhat strong, I respect that.
Anna Wintour talking with Barbara Walters, Harriet Mays Powell at New York Magazine. This is the first New York Fashion Week since the movie came out and made its big splash, I guess. Is it now the new kind of Hollywood backdrop to fashion in New York? Are people talking about it, aware of it, reacting to it?
I think the industry knows it so well that going to see The Devil Wears Prada as an insider was a little like
redundant.
You know, Coles to Newcastle, as the English would say. But what I do think is topical is this whole conversation about food and fashion. I must say, happily, journalistically, our spring fashion issue is the connection of fashion and food is the topic. Because it's not Vogue, we do something a little different in our fashion pages at New York Magazine. But
does that connection mean that you leave room for something in the tummy in your fashion?
Indeed. You know, it can be as lighthearted as I've done Tutti Frutti colors, and we did costume jewelry and Jell-O, known affectionately with my girls as Blingo. So there's a very lighthearted touch on it, but there's a big feature being done by one of our staff writers about models and this weight issue and food and what it means. And it's been around for a long time, and you touched on it on the program today, and it's a huge issue.
Is the corner being turned here? Are we pulling away from the death-defying skinniness?
Yeah, I think, you know, these women, they're very young, and they're barely women, and the influences on teenagers is tough. Tough for everybody, and I think the pressures of fashion and this whole thing of beauty, these girls coming from unbelievably different backgrounds, most of them from less well-off places.
From all over the world, increasingly.
Yeah, and, you know, they come to this big glamorous world. I mean, you know, it's Cinderella. And I think everyone is very aware that the influence of models and the designers and the fashion editors and the model bookers that take care of them have as a responsibility in really thinking thoughtfully about weight and a concern. So it's a huge topic that's going on now, and one that I think should be addressed and brought to everyone's conscience.
Both for them and for everybody who hesitates before they put that nutritious bit of food to their mouths. Harriet Mays Powell, fashion director at New York Magazine, it's been great having you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Marianne LaFrance at Yale, professor of psychology and women's and gender studies there. You're terrific, Marianne. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.